Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Last week, President Trump ordered that the Department of Homeland Security detain together, quote, alien families, unquote, who had crossed a U.S. border. The president said, I didn't like the sight or feeling of families being separated. At the same time, we're keeping a very powerful border, but continue to be zero tolerance. So what does zero tolerance look like now? I've got two guests with us to answer your questions about that. Kara Lynam is an immigration attorney at Lynam Law in St. Paul. She joins me in the studio. Hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And Nina Satija is a reporter with the Texas Tribune and Reveal. She joins us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Nina. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
Nina, I want to start with you. Oh, actually, let me give out the phone number so people can call in with their questions, as I told them they could. So if you have a question about the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Nina, since the executive order last week, how have things changed down there? Are things do things feel different or look different?
Yeah, it's interesting, Stephanie. I was there on Thursday and for most of Friday as well. And then I guess I can say on the ground, things didn't really look different. Now, it's important to understand that, you know, on the Texas-Mexico border, you're not seeing this happen out in the open, right? These family reunifications are often going to happen, you know, maybe in an airport, in a detention center, behind closed doors, and that's also where the separations are happening. So it's hard to really know just from being on the border exactly what's happening. But what I can tell you is that the advocates we talked to and the families that we talked to are not at all reassured that families will be reunited. It's really not clear how this is all going to play out. We did also go to the federal courthouse down in Brownsville on Thursday and Friday. That's where this zero tolerance policy was playing out, where adults are getting prosecuted for illegally crossing the border. And at that point, it didn't appear that anything had changed in those courthouses, despite the signing of the executive order or any other indication of a policy change.
And it wasn't going to change for adults who are coming over by themselves, correct? Even if they were seeking asylum.
That's my understanding. I mean, I think, you know, what everyone, including Republicans, has really reacted to is this issue of children getting taken away mm-hmm. from their parents. And of course, what they're finding now is addressing only that issue by itself is proving to be quite difficult.
Kara, this executive order is going forward. They are no longer going to detain adults and parents and their children separately. How are they reuniting the families who've already been separated?
You know, I think that process is unclear at best. There doesn't seem to be any clear process for parents to go find their kids. You know, some of these children are quite young. They may not know anything. You know, they might not be able to even speak their name or anything like that. So it's been unclear how they're actually going to reunite these 2,000-plus kids who now are detained without their parents.
Do those kids have lawyers that are representing them, or who is their advocate, if they have any?
So there are no, like, public defenders or free attorneys in immigration court. So those children would either be represented by pro bono or volunteer attorneys or have no attorneys at all helping them.
And how do the volunteer attorneys find them?
It's a good question. The government is not super forthcoming about the location of these centers, and it is difficult to have access to counsel for these children.
Okay. Nina, what do you know about how the reunification could happen? Have you seen any? Are there any reunifications that you've heard of, and how did it happen?
Yeah, this is a question that's been on everybody's mind, obviously, for the last week or so. You know, I have not seen any reunifications happen. Last week, I was at a press conference and roundtable hosted by Senators Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, both Republicans of Texas. And we were told there that several hundred children had been reunited with their parents, at least in the Rio Grande Valley sector in South Texas. But we know that still, I believe that at least thousands have still not, been reunited. Our understanding from the roundtable discussion and the press availability that was held afterward on Friday is that what's going to happen, it's really not clear. We were told that for children under the age of five, who may not really be verbal yet, who may not be able to say, hey, my parents' name is this, and here's what she or he looks like, there will be DNA testing that happens. We were told it's going to be a really complicated process. Customs and Border Protection mentioned, well, sometimes you have kids that make an outcry about their parent about abuse, and then we've got to investigate that before we reunite them. The DNA testing, we were told, takes 7 to 10 days. It was interesting, an official from I believe from ICE said, you know, sometimes it can just take a few days for us to transport kids back to their families. And then an advocate at the roundtable piped up and said, well, no, I've heard it can take as long as 4 months. And he kind of responded to that and said, well, yeah, it could take as long as 4 months. So that just tells you that we really don't have much of an idea of how this is going to happen or how long it's going to take. It's all very unclear.
Jeff from Shoreview called in. Let me give out that number for everybody else. The number is 651-227-6000. Or 1-800-242-2828. Jeff, sorry to introduce you and then give out the phone number and not go right to you. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I think I could live with that. anyway, I'd like to ask your guests and even you to weigh in. I know that there's a difference between the American media coverage of what's going on along the border with the kids and such, and then BBC World the last few days. BBC World, instead of sending reporters to the border, decided to take a look at proximate cause. In other words, why are we having literally a worldwide refugee crisis? They sent reporters to the Sahel in Africa, where the climate change is destroying what few jobs and livelihoods there are there, forcing people to leave. And then they went with a reporter down to Guatemala, where they interviewed people, and one was a woman who explained that with communities within some of the cities and whole towns being under the control of the gangs, where the gang leader literally selected their daughter to, be his companion, shall we say, and those things being why the people came here. And so the question I've got is just that. Would the difference in media coverage, if we had it for everybody, change the debate?
Thank you so much for calling, Jeff. Nina, I'm going to have you respond to that. Do you feel like American news coverage of this often gets into a tunnel vision where we're just looking at our border and nothing else?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I really appreciate that call. And I do think that absolutely. I mean, the media, us included, have what I usually call a herd mentality. We all want to rush down to the same place. And I think I could go on to answer your question for a while here, but I'm going to touch on one point that was made, which is the question of where to go. Does everyone need to go down to the border to cover this? And I really think the answer to that is no. I mean, these stories are playing out all over the United States, forgetting even, I think, the really important stories of telling what's going on in these countries where children and their parents are fleeing from Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. Is also just what's happening in the communities in the United States where people are already living, waiting to be reunited with family members that maybe they crossed over the border, a year ago, and now they're waiting for their family to cross with them. What's happening in these detention centers are all over the United States. They're not just along the Texas-Mexico border. We know that kids are now being sent to New York and all kinds of cities that are far from the U.S.-Mexico border. So I absolutely think that probably a lot of reporters were sent down to where I was last week in the Rio Grande Valley and El Paso and really didn't know what to do because this crisis is not just playing out on the border, and it's certainly not just playing out at the ports of entry and on the Rio Grande River. I mean, it's playing out in so many other places. I would also just, you know, like to make a plug. The Texas Tribune did a huge project on this very issue called Bordering on Insecurity, where we had reporters actually go to Guatemala and some of these other countries where they're facing such severe crises right now. And so I'd encourage you to check out that coverage. I do think the media has done a great job with this story, but it's probably in the background right now, and it probably should be more in the forefront.
Great. Kara, you're not a member of the media. What do you think of the media coverage?
Well, I'm sitting in a media studio right now.
So. I know, but feel free. Throw some punches.
No, I would never do that. You know, I think there are a lot more stories to be told about this. Mm-hmm. You know, these families hopefully will not be removed from the United States and will have a chance to pursue possible asylum claims. And asylum is very difficult to win. These families will be released and be in a court process, hopefully together. So this will play out across the country over a long period of time, over years, as these families fight through our system. So I think there is a lot of story left to tell. Hopefully this crisis will end at some point, mm-hmm. and there will be lots of story left to tell, you know, even here in Minnesota.
Why is asylum so hard to win? What do you have to do to get asylum, to prove that you need it?
A lot. So you have to, and I should back up and say that Attorney General Jeff Sessions issued a decision called Matter of AB, I think 2 weeks ago today, that will make it more difficult for many of these families to get asylum who are claiming asylum based on domestic violence or gang violence. So you have that compounding what's going on. But asylum more generally is difficult to win because it's a high standard you have to meet. You're expected to have any documents that would prove your case. You're required to have those under the Real ID law, which most people think is just about driver's licenses, but actually is about asylum documentation as well. And it's a very stressful process, too. There's a lot of very minute details that people have to cue in on. And again, like I said, there are no public defenders or anything helping folks apply for asylum. So it's a very difficult benefit to win.
Is this something, paperwork and documentation, that they need to start before they leave? And is there anyone to help them on that end?
In some cases, if an applicant has gone to the police and there's a police report, or if there's a death certificate or any other sort of civil document that they would need to have hopefully brought with them, or hopefully exists at all. If there's been any sort of civil strife in the home country, it's possible all those documents were destroyed. And there's not really anyone that goes and gets those documents. Maybe a family member is still in the home country, but then there's the issue of, is it safe to go ask for those documents? Is that a cue to local authorities in the home country that someone is abroad and asking for asylum? And is the family still in the home country now at risk because of that?
Okay, let's go to the phones. Kelly is calling from White Bear Lake. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, good morning. With all the attention being focused on the southern border, how does last week's executive order affect those who have flown and their families who have flown from other continents and have maybe overstayed their work visa or student visa, et cetera?
Good question, Kelly. Kara?
It shouldn't impact them at all. The executive order from last week really only applies to people who are presenting themselves either at the port of entry or between ports of entry at the southern border. So anyone who has come on a non-immigrant visa, like a student or visitor visa or any other type of visa, and has decided to ask for asylum after they've been here for a little while, wouldn't impact their process.
Okay. We are talking about the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy on illegal immigration. If you have a question, call us at 651-227-6000 or call 1-800-242-2828. I've got two guests. Kara Lynham is an immigration attorney at Lynham Law in St. Paul, and Nina Satija is with the Texas Tribune and Reveal. Nina, just today, President Donald Trump has been tweeting about immigration all for the past week, and today he said that immigrants simply must be stopped at the border. How feasible is this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's that feasible. I would imagine Customs and Border Protection has been saying this for years. You know, however they may feel about the situation, they're saying it's there's not enough resources to actually do that. You know, I did see some of this play out last week in Brownsville at the port of entry. So the bridge, that crosses from Brownsville, Texas, into Matamoros, Mexico. On your way back, crossing from Mexico into the U.S., there were actually three Customs and Border Protection agents stationed smack in the middle of the bridge, which is pretty unusual. Normally, you can walk all the way across the bridge into the U.S., and then you get to this kind of little building, a processing station, and that's where you might say, hey, I want to seek asylum, or you're just crossing, you've got your passport, you've got your documents, and they let you through. Now, you can't even cross all the way, you can't even cross the bridge all the way without showing your documents. And if you don't have documents, so you're an asylum seeker, we saw folks just camped out in the middle of the bridge, just sitting there waiting. And CBP told them to wait. Now, our understanding is that they were not technically being denied asylum. They were being told, wait a few days and come back. Of course, they didn't have anywhere to go, so they would just sit there on the bridge. It was a very unusual situation. So this is how I think we're seeing some of that play out right now. People literally getting stopped when they're crossing, but I don't see how it's feasible to stop folks from crossing. I mean, this has been the debate all along. Do we build a wall? That's enormously expensive and probably also not going to deter people from coming across in other ways. Do we have Border Patrol agents stationed at every inch of, border crossing, whether it's, the port of entry or the river? Again, probably not feasible from a resources standpoint. So, I think it's just, regardless of your politics, I think it's just an impossible task.
Kara, I wanted to ask you about another thing that President Trump tweeted. He says, when somebody comes in, we must immediately, with no judges or court cases, bring them back from where they came. I mean, this was only a tweet, not an executive order, but could that be done?
No. I mean, we are a nation of laws, and we do have a really broad array of immigration laws and regulations. And we also have international obligations to asylum seekers who come to our border and are seeking safety and protection. So, no, we can't just remove people, deport people without any of our court process, because even non-citizens, the Supreme Court has said, do have due process rights here in the United States.
When was that? Is it in the Constitution, or what ruling? What did the Supreme Court?
It's Zedvius v. U.S. I don't remember the year off the top of my head, but it's a Supreme Court case.
Okay. I was just wondering. Yeah. Didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, I got it. All right.
Good. You're good. Let's go to Tony in Shakopee. He is on the phones. He called, and I wanted to get a question out there. One of my producers said I should ask this. She wants me to ask, if you've been through the asylum process, we would love to hear from you. So if you've been through it, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Tony Shakopee, hi. How are you doing?
Doing well. Good. Two comments. One is, the line has to be drawn somewhere. These people are coming. I mean, we can't handle them as a nation. We have other issues, guest you had on earlier about, what about infrastructure? What if we have other issues as a country? We can't keep dealing with these immigrants. And I think they're kind of making a last ditch effort. I mean, they pay attention to the news as well, and they know that wall hasn't begun to be built yet. I think they're making a last ditch effort as far as making a crapshoot chance to come over here. And then what about the ruling Flores versus Reno? In 1997, I thought that that law stated that if those minors came across or the parents and children came across, they had to be separated. And in 2014, there was a case that a child was ended up dying or something like that, and they sued the Obama administration. I'm laughing at these Democrats. You've got what's her name from Massachusetts, Pocahontas coming and Booker.
Tony, thank you for calling. A couple of questions there. One, Kara, can you explain the Flores ruling and what exactly it was and how it worked out? And then I wanted to ask Nina about how many immigrants are coming over right now compared to other times. But first, let's talk about Flores.
Yeah, I think Tony has a deep misunderstanding of what Flores is. So the Flores settlement came up from unaccompanied minors appearing at our border in the 1980s. Was signed in 1997. So it's a court-ordered agreement between immigration authorities and unaccompanied minors, basically. It's a court case about the standard of care for children in immigration custody. Mm-hmm. So it created these standards. It did not require family separation. It did not require that children be kept anywhere. I mean, it was just about standards. And the standards are that they're supposed to be released from custody as quickly as possible, preferably to a parent, and that they are in the least restrictive and applicable, appropriate setting for their age. It's supposed to be non-secure. It's supposed to be licensed. But the Flores settlement does not apply to Office of Refugee Resettlement facilities, which many unaccompanied minors end up in, the Flores settlement then came into a big way in 2014 when President Obama created the family detention centers.
Mm-hmm.
The family detention centers that exist today in Dilley, Texas, Karnes, Texas, and Berks, Pennsylvania are not compliant with Flores. So the government is required.
Why not or how not?
They're not licensed and they are secure.
Okay.
They are basically jails with children in them. So they're kept with their parents, but they're absolutely horrific conditions. Medical conditions are horrible. Access to counsel is bad. The food is bad. The kids get sick. It's absolutely horrific, especially keeping in light that these are asylum seekers that we are holding in jail. So that's what Flores is. It's not about requiring anyone to be separated. It's nothing about that. It's about the standard of care that we as a country owe to these children.
Okay. Nina, have you seen the family detention centers that that were set up under the Obama administration?
I have not personally seen them. I have a number of colleagues that have, both at Reveal and the Texas Tribune, and, you know, I think their observations would probably concur with exactly what Kara is saying. You know, in fact, I would encourage people to take a look at a Reveal show called Sick on the Inside. I believe that was reported from the Dilley, Texas facility. Absolutely very, very difficult conditions in here. I'd like to actually address one other thing that the caller, I think his name is Tony, had said, which is just sort of, you know, this seems like an untenable problem. I mean, we can't just keep accepting people into the country is the argument. You know, something has to give. And I do think this is a really difficult situation. One thing I can say, you know, even in my capacity as a journalist that I've observed is, when you look at this family separation thing, it does make me wonder because it's creating a whole other infrastructure that the government has to create now. It's got to build more shelters, find more beds for kids, provide health care for them, give them food and medical care, potentially even educate them if they're going to be here for, you know, longer periods of time. All of that now has to be set up, along with an infrastructure for reunification. So these databases that are created, phone communications, you know, a whole infrastructure so that parents who are detained can communicate with their children who are detained elsewhere. So I just think that's an important thing to note as well, that what's happening right now and the impact of family separation is putting an additional strain on the U.S. government, I would imagine. The DNA testing to reunite kids with their parents when they came together were then separated. And it is just... I think it's an important thing to note that an enormous amount of money is going to be spent on that as well. And I think we should be asking the question of why.
The other thing that Tony had said was that, you know, this is a last ditch effort, or he has a feeling of it being a crisis at the border on par of almost like 2014, when we did have this surge of unaccompanied minors coming across. Is there a large surge right now of immigrants coming to the border seeking asylum? Nina?
I wish I had the numbers in front of me, Stephanie, and unfortunately I don't, so I don't want to misspeak. But I do remember from the press conference I was at on Friday, Manuel Padilla, the chief of the Rio Grande Valley sector of the Border Patrol, did indicate that the numbers are at least similar to what they were in 2014. My recollection is he mentioned 51,000 family units, so I think, you know, not just unaccompanied children, but actually families coming across in 2014. That's my recollection. I could be wrong. I think he expected that number to stay the same or actually be surpassed this year. He also seemed to think that in terms of the number of unaccompanied minors, that would also be at least similar, if not surpassed. So I don't think there's a sense that the numbers are going to be much less than they were back in 2014, from what I've heard.
Let's go to the phones. Nancy in Duluth is on the line. Hi, Nancy. You have an experience you want to talk about or share.
Yes. I lived in a border state, New Mexico, for over 21 years before moving back to Duluth. In 1996, I was accompanying a group of church volunteers. Back then, you could just walk from El Paso to Ciudad Juarez because it was a border zone. You didn't need anything but your driver's license. And I had one young black man, and it was white. Everybody else in that group was white. And we were taking a trip. These were students who were going to go to Central America as young pastors and church workers. And they were going to do an exchange with the pastors there. So this was they were all college grads. The only person that was stopped on the bridge was the young black man. And he, you know, and interrogated. That told me that immigration policies, our government policies at border crossings, wherever possible, are really motivated, just like they are now, and it hasn't changed. It's gotten worse, but it's a color thing. People say, well, why are we spending all these resources at the border? Why are we doing this? I see everyone, all the speakers, all the talkers dancing around the issue. This has got to be because we don't want dark-skinned people in our country.
All right. Thank you, Nancy, for calling in. She was talking about 1996, Kara. Does that seem like the borders are still, that would still be a litmus test at a border if you went to the crossing?
I mean, we have so many issues at the physical, we call them ports of entry, mm-hmm. at the crossings. I mean, we still have, you know, they are turning, you know, we spoke earlier about what's happening at the bridges. And there are many documented cases now of asylum seekers being turned away or told to wait when our law and our international obligations require them to be processed in for asylum. Doesn't mean they're going to get asylum, but it means they'll at least have the opportunity to be screened and ask for it. So, you know, we're seeing all this stuff that's been happening for years at our ports of entry. And I'm glad it's getting the attention that it's getting now because it needs to be reformed.
Nina, what did you think about Nancy's comments?
Well, you know, I mean, absolutely, this has been the allegation for a long time. Why are we focusing on this particular aspect of immigration? I mean, you know, there's immigration has a lot of facets to it. It's not just happening on the Texas-Mexico border, mm-hmm. Or on the U.S.-Mexico border. So certainly there have been allegations of that. And I think there's a lot of questions as to how, you know, President Trump was able to mobilize his base on this issue, and in particular in towns across the U.S. where immigration is really not an issue at all, where people are not moving to, there are not a lot of undocumented workers or people living there, and yet this has become, you know, the flashpoint political issue in those areas. It's a question. It's an interesting question as to why that is.
Let's go to the phones because we got a lot of callers lined up now. I want to get to them. Mike in Minnetonka. Hello, Mike. Welcome to NPR News. What's your question?
I've got a question. Right now, there's like a backlog of 800,000 people looking for asylum, and I assume those people are wandering around the United States waiting for their court date. How do they make money? Do they have some sort of a work visa, or are they given some ability to make money, or are they just begging, or how does that work,
Kara?
It's a great question. So asylum applicants are generally allowed to ask for work permission after they've been here a certain number of months. So they get a work permit, which allows them to work, to get a driver's license in most states, to have a social security number. And that's renewable because, as he mentioned, there is kind of a backlog for these cases, and they've changed how they're prioritizing cases for asylum interviews. So these people are allowed to work and drive and while they wait for their cases to be decided.
Let's go to the phones again. Paul in Wayzata. Hello, Paul. How are you?
Pretty good.
Good.
My question is I guess I'm wondering about what I've been seeing on the news and reading is that people are being stopped on highways and asking to provide proof of citizenship, or being taken off of buses, planes, and provide proof of citizenship. Isn't that illegal to do that to U.S. citizens?
Hmm. Yep. Kara? Yep. So there's kind of two different things here. So there's the 100-mile zone within our near our border where CBP, Customs and Border Protection, has the ability to ask people about their status. But U.S. citizens are not required to answer that question. You can just not answer it. Of course, that may result in making someone mad and you're being held for a little while and they may not like that. But, you know, we don't have a sort of show me your papers situation here. You are allowed to not answer that question.
But within that 100 miles, they can ask that question?
So they can board buses and they can go through and do all that, but you're not under any obligation to share any information. Okay. They're supposed to have reasonable suspicion, and just sitting on a bus or just being on the highway isn't enough to have reasonable suspicion about your immigration status.
How do you see that play out down in Texas, Nina?
Yeah, this is what the border checkpoints are all about. So, I've obviously crossed a few of these on my way back from the Texas-Mexico border. You're just driving on the highway and you need to come to a stop. I believe you do have to stop. You can't just blow through the checkpoint. But yes, you don't have to answer any questions. But I'm always asked, are you a U.S. citizen? You know, I'm able to answer yes. I've sometimes had people in the car who have had to say no. We've chosen to just answer the question, even though we're not obliged to. And then, you know, we get varying, you know, some people just sort of let us go through anyway, and others ask a lot of questions. I've been with someone who was told that he needs to have his passport next time, which I don't think is the case. You don't need to have your passport while you're driving on a highway. As long as you have your driver's license, you should be fine. So it's a pretty, it's a pretty interesting situation what goes on at the border checkpoints. But I think they're also, you know, the idea from what I've heard is there to sort of serve as a you know, another type of deterrent, obviously, for people that don't have documents. But again, yes, as Kara said, you're not obliged to, you're not obligated to answer any of their questions. Of course, on the ground when you're there and you're saying, I don't want to answer your questions, and you've got someone looking at you who's, you know, a member of law enforcement and has a weapon, you may want to make another calculation about that.
Back to the phones. We got a lot of calls. Ludwin is in St. Paul. Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine, thanks. Hey, thank you for having the show. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
My question is, do either of your guests have are able to verify the government's claim that over 500 children have already been reunited mm-hmm. with their parents? I'm wondering that claim really seems pretty unsubstantiated to me, and I'm wondering if anybody can verify that.
Nina? Thank you, Ludwin. Thanks for calling. Nina, what do you know about any families that have been reunited?
That's a really interesting question. You know, I don't think we can do that. I think a lot of the questions being asked here and answered, we have to rely on the government for these numbers. There's no one that I know of who can really check them. I mean, we've certainly seen isolated reports of media reports of children being reunited with their parents. So we know that it has, in fact, happened. Has it happened with the 522 migrant children? I believe that's the most recent number. Has it happened with all of those children? Have they all really been reunited with their parents? I mean, I think all we can do is hope that the government has the right information itself and is giving us the correct information. That I don't see how, unfortunately, we could verify that independently, that exact number.
Kara?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's no way for us to know. And then I think even if they are reunited, are they still in detention? Are they in a family detention center now?
Absolutely.
So who knows?
Elizabeth in Minneapolis is on the line. Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for calling.
Hi, thank you. I would like to address the problem that I've not heard yet, and that is that America has had a huge political footprint in virtually every single one of these countries, and we have screwed them up one side and down the other, and any time Negroponte and other of his ilk are involved, the country that is involved has suffered. And so we are part of the reason why that these people are coming, and I would like that to be addressed because it's never mentioned.
Thank you for calling, Elizabeth. This is about international diplomacy too, right, Kara?
Yeah, I mean, the United States has a really long history of being in these countries, and we think, you know, thinking specifically even about MS-13, which President Trump frequently speaks about, mm-hmm. you know, that was a Los Angeles-based, or at least California-based gang that then they were deported and ended up in El Salvador back home, and then it flourished there. So that's just one example of the ways that U.S. actions have sort of led to where we are today in this crisis.
Let's go to Ali in Fargo, North Dakota. We've got a little bit of time, and I wanted to hear from Ali. Hi.
Yes. Hi, ma'am. I just came back because I just want to ask a question. How long will a accompanied minor, you know, if being separated from their parents, you know, as the U.S. Constitution, what did it say?
How long can they be separated? How long can the children be separated from their parents? Is there any law saying, rules saying that they can only be separated this long or that long, Kara?
There is no law on that. I mean, mm-hmm. it would just be at some point, I assume, a constitutional issue of detention of a, you know, is that appropriate? But there is no ceiling on how long a child could be held.
And who is holding them at this point?
So the unaccompanied minors, which some of them are forcibly unaccompanied, are in the custody and care of Health and Human Services, and the Office of Refugee Resettlement runs those unaccompanied minor, what they call shelters, but I would call jails.
Okay. Let's go to one more call. Jane in Lanesboro. Hi, Jane. What did you want to say?
I just wanted to address the issue that Tony brought up about we don't have room for all these people. We can't possibly handle all of these immigrants. And see if you all might address the idea that we, because of our demographics, we have a workforce that's getting smaller and smaller. Agricultural industries are now complaining they cannot get enough workers as of this year right now. And that includes many other industries, meatpacking, restaurants, mm-hmm. the list goes on. And we don't have the people who are interested and want to fulfill these positions. We need these immigrants. So please address that.
Thank you for calling. Nina, we only have a minute left, but how do immigrants contribute to the workforce down where you are?
Yeah, I mean it's huge. It's absolutely. I mean, after Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, you know, we've had a huge influx of immigrant workers. You know, for things like construction, you know, rebuilding flooded homes. It's a huge problem. I think I'll also point you to a story pretty recently about President Donald Trump's own Mar-a-Lago, I believe. You know, he's asked for several dozen visas a year for foreign guest workers. And these are maids. These are cooks. These are people that, clean the rooms. He needs these workers as well for his own businesses.
Thank you both for being here. We're out of time already. Thank you for all the callers. Kara Lynam is an immigration attorney at Lynam Law in St. Paul. And Nina Satija works with the fabulous Texas Tribune and Reveal, which is a vital journalism resource. And I recommend you check it out. Thank you both.
Thanks so much.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.